Chapter 6. Not a wiseacre in Blackwood's magazine lately fall foul of Om Jones. Oh, hypercritic. So, to be sure, did good old Mr. Richardson, who could write novels himself but you, and I, and Mr. Gibbon, my dear sir, agree in giving our respect, and wonder, and admiration, to the brave old master. In these last words I am supposing the respected reader to be endowed with a sense of humor, which he may or may not possess. Indeed, don't we know many an honest man who can no more comprehend a joke than he can turn a tune? But I take for granted, my dear sir, that you are brimming over with fun. You mayn't make jokes, but you could, if you would, you know you could. And in your quiet way you enjoy them extremely. Now many people neither make them, nor understand them when made, nor like them when understood, and are suspicious, testy, and angry with jokers. Have you ever watched an elderly male or female, an elderly arty, so to speak, who begins to find out that some young wag of the company is halfing him? Have you ever tried the sarcastic or Socratic method with a child? Little simple he or she, in the innocence of the simple heart, plays some silly freak, or makes some absurd remark, which you turn to ridicule. The little creature dimly perceives that you are making fun of him, writhes, blushes, grows uneasy, bursts into tears. Upon my word, it is not fair to try the weapon of ridicule upon that innocent young victim. The awful objurgatory practice he is accustomed to. Point out his fault, and lay bare the dire consequences thereof. Expose it roundly, and give him a proper, solemn, moral whipping, but do not attempt to castigate or reprimand. Do not laugh at him writhing, and cause all the other boys in the school to laugh. Remember your own young days at school, my friend. The tingling cheeks, burning ears, bursting heart, and passion of desperate tears, with which you looked up, after having performed some blunder, whilst the doctor held you to public scorn before the class, and cracked his great clumsy jokes upon you helpless, and a prisoner. Better the block itself, and the lictors, with their fasces of birch twigs, than the maddening torture of those jokes. Now with respect to jokes and the present company, of course accepted many people, perhaps most people, are as infants. They have little sense of humor. They don't like jokes. Raillery in writing annoys and offends them. The coarseness apart, I think I have met very, very few women who like the banter of Swift and Fielding. Their simple, tender natures revolt at laughter. Is the satyr always a wicked brute at heart, and are they rightly shocked at his grin, his leer, his horns, hoofs, and ears? Fi donc, le vilain monster, with his shrieks, and his capering crooked legs. Let him go and get a pair of well-wadded black silk stockings, and pull them over those horrid shanks, put a large gown and bands over beard and hide, and pour a dozen of lavender water into his long handkerchief, and cry, and never make a joke again. It shall all be highly distilled PC, and perfumed sentiment, and gushing eloquence, and the foot shan't peep out, and a plague take it. Cover it up with the surplice. Out with your cambric, dear ladies, and let us all whimper together. Now then, hand on heart, we declare that it is not the fire of adverse critics which afflicts, or frightens the editorial bosom. They may be right. They may be rogues who have a personal spite, they may be dullards who kick and bray as their nature is to do, and prefer thistles to pineapples. They may be conscientious, acute, deeply learned, delightful judges, who see your joke in a moment, and the profound wisdom lying underneath. Wise or dull, laudatory or otherwise, we put their opinions aside. If they applaud, we are pleased. If they shake their quick pens, and fly off with a hiss, we resign their favors and put on all the fortitude we can muster. I would rather have the lowest man's good word than his bad one, to be sure, but as for coaxing a compliment, or wheedling him into good humor, or stopping his angry mouth with a good dinner, or accepting his contributions for a certain magazine, for fear of his barking or snapping elsewhere Allen's dunk, these shall not be our acts. Bow wow, Cerberus. Here shall be no sop for thee, unless Cerberus is an uncommonly good dog, when we shall bear no malice, because he flew at us from our neighbor's gate. What, then, is the main grief you spoke of as annoying you? The toothache in the Lord Mayor's jaw, the thorn in the cushion of the editorial chair. It is there. Ah! It stings me now as I write. It comes with almost every morning's post. At night I come home and take my letters up to bed, not daring to open them, and in the morning I find one, two, three thorns on my pillow. Three I extracted yesterday, two I found this morning. They don't sting quite so sharply as they did, but a skin is a skin, and they bite, after all, most wickedly. It is all very fine to advertise on the magazine. Contributions are only to be sent to Messrs. Smith, Elder, and Company, and not to the editor's private residence. My dear sir, how little you know man or womankind, if you fancy they will take that sort of warning. How am I to know, though? To be sure, I begin to know now, as I take the letters off the tray, which of those envelopes contains a real bona fide letter, and which a thorn. One of the best invitations this year I mistook for a thorn letter, and kept it without opening. This is what I call a thorn letter. Camberwell, June 4. Sir, may I hope, may I entreat, that you will favor me by perusing the enclosed lines, and that they may be found worthy of insertion in the Cornhill Magazine. We have known better days, sir. I have a sick and widowed mother to maintain, and little brothers and sisters who look to me. I do my utmost as a governess to support them. I toil at night, when they are at rest, and my own hand and brain are alike tired. If I could add but a little to our means by my pen, many of my poor invalid's wants might be supplied, and I could procure for her comforts to which she is now a stranger. Heaven knows it is not for want of will or for want of energy on my part, that she is now in ill health, and our little household almost without bread. Do cast a kind glance over my poem, and if you can help us, the widow, the orphans will bless you. I remain, sir, in anxious expectancy, your faithful servant, S.S.S. And enclosed is a little poem or two, and an envelope with its penny stamp, heaven help us. And the writer's name and address. Now you see what I mean by a thorn. Here is the case put with true female logic. I'm poor, I am good, I am ill, I work hard. I have a sick mother and hungry brothers and sisters dependent on me. You can help us if you will. And then I look at the paper, with the thousandth part of a faint hope, that it may be suitable, and I find it won't do. And I knew it wouldn't do. And why is this poor lady, to appeal to my pity, and bring her poor little ones kneeling to my bedside, and calling for bread which I can give them if I choose? No day passes, but that argument ad misericordium is used. Day and night, that sad voice is crying out for help. Thrice it appealed to me yesterday. Twice this morning it cried to me. And I have no doubt, when I go to get my hat, I shall find it with its piteous face, and its pale family about it, waiting for me in the hall. One of the immense advantages which women have over our sex is, that they actually like to read these letters. Like letters? Oh, mercy on us! Before I was an editor I did not like the postman much. But now, a very common way with these petitioners is to begin with a fine flummery about the merits and eminent genius of the person whom they are addressing. But this artifice, I state publicly, is of no avail. When I see that kind of herb, I know the snake within it, and fling it away before it has time to sting. Away, reptile, to the waste paper basket, and thence to the flames. But of these disappointed people, some take their disappointment and meekly bear it. Some hate and hold you their enemy, because you could not be their friend. Some, furious and envious, say, colon, who is this man who refuses what I offer, and how dares he, the conceited coxcomb, to deny my merit? Sometimes my letters contain not mere thorns, but bludgeons. How our two choice slips from that noble Irish oak, which has more than once supplied alpines for this meek and unoffending skull. Theatre Royal, Donnybrook. Sir, I have just finished reading the first portion of your tale, Lovel the Widower, and am much surprised at the unwarrantable strictures you pass there on the corps de ballet. I have been for more than 10 years connected with the theatrical profession, and I beg to assure you that the majority of the corps de ballet are virtuous, well-conducted girls, and, consequently, that snug cottages are not taken for them in the Regent's Park. I also have to inform you that theatrical managers are in the habit of speaking good English, possibly better English than authors. You either know nothing of the subject in question, or you assert a willful falsehood. I am happy to say that the characters of the corps de ballet, as also those of actors and actresses, are superior to the snarlings of dyspeptic libellers, or the spiteful attacks and brutum fomen of ephemeral authors. I am, sir, your obedient servant, ABC, the editor of the Cornhill Magazine. Theatre Royal, Donnybrook. Sir, I have just read in the Cornhill Magazine for January, the first portion of a tale written by you, and entitled Lovel the Widower. In the production in question you employ all your malicious spite and you have great capabilities, that way, in trying, to degrade the character of the corps de ballet. When you imply that the majority of ballet girls have villas taken for them in the Regent's Park, I say you tell a deliberate falsehood. Having been brought up to the stage from infancy, and though now an actress, having been 7 years principal dancer at the opera, I am competent to speak on the subject. I am only surprised that so vile a libeller as yourself should be allowed to preside at the dramatic fun dinner on the 22nd instant. I think it would be much better if you were to reform your own life, instead of telling lies of those who are immeasurably your superiors. Yours in supreme disgust, A.D. The signatures of the respected writers are altered, and for the site of their Theatre Royal and adjacent places named, which, as I may have been falsely informed, used to be famous for quarrels, thumps, and broken heads. But, I say, is this an easy chair to sit on, when you are liable to have a pair of such shillelaghs flung at it? And, prithee, what was all the quarrel about? In the little history of Lovel the Widower I described, and brought to condign punishment, a certain wretch of a ballet dancer, who lived splendidly for a while on ill-gotten gains, had an accident, and lost her beauty, and died poor, deserted, ugly, and every way odious. In the same page, other little ballet dancers are described, wearing homely clothing, doing their duty, and carrying their humble savings to the family at home. But nothing will content my dear correspondents, but to have me declare that the majority of ballet dancers have villas in the Regent's Park, and to convict me of deliberate falsehood. Suppose, for instance, I had chosen to introduce a red-haired washerwoman into a story? I might get an expostulatory letter saying, "Sir, in stating that the majority of washerwomen are red-haired, you are a liar. And you had best not speak of ladies who are immeasurably your superiors." Or suppose I had ventured to describe an illiterate haberdasher. One of the craft might write to me, "Sir, in describing haberdashers as illiterate, you utter a willful falsehood. Haberdashers use much better English than authors." It is a mistake, to be sure. I have never said what my correspondents say I say. There is the text under their noses, but what if they choose to read it their own way? Hurroo, lads! Here's for a fight. There's a bald head peeping out of the hut. There's a bald head. It must be Tim Malone's. And whack! Come down both the bludgeons at once. Ah me, we wound where we never intended to strike, we create anger where we never meant harm, and these thoughts are the thorns in our cushion. Out of mere malignity, I suppose, there is no man who would like to make enemies. But here, in this editorial business, you can't do otherwise. And a queer, sad, strange, bitter thought it is, that must cross the mind of many a public man, colon, do what I will, be innocent or spiteful, be generous or cruel, there are A and B, and C and D, who will hate me to the end of the chapter to the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.